Welcome to the Brown County Hour.
Coming to you from the legendary hills of Brown.
Where the plum purple haze,
the one nature herself drapes over the hills and hollers,
inspires local characters, artists, and nature lovers.
It's as though the hills themselves conspire to create a beauty and a culture in the heart of Indiana.
Sit for a spell and hear the music.
The tall tales.
True stories.
And current goings on.
Brought to you by folks who still know how to sit by a fire in winter.
And swim buck naked in summer.
Welcome to episode 21 of the Brown County Hour. This is Dave Seastrom.
And this is Lee Edwin.
Drawing from the deep well of all things Brown County, we have another fine show for you this morning. What do we have for our listeners, Lee?
This morning, we begin with a presentation from local actor Ian McCabe as he gives us a taste from It's a Wonderful Life radio play at the Brown County Playhouse, some music and conversation with local big band luminary Mel Chance, and another fine essay from Dave Seastrom.
We also have a shocking report about local hippies, more history from Bill Land, a poem from Gunther Flum, and a live recording of the dedication of the Salt Creek Trail.
Finally, we bring you some poetic observations from Chris Curtin, an interview with local artist Ann Ryan Miller, and more conversation with Charlie Cole and Linda Baden detailing the history of our local forest lands.
Hello, I'm Ian McCabe with Two Pigs Productions at the Brown County Playhouse. We are currently performing It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play adapted by Joe Landry from the classic film by Frank Capra. It will be running until Sunday, December 16th, every Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, and Sundays at 2 p.m. at the Brown County Playhouse, downtown Nashville, Indiana. The play is a radio adaptation, so It's a Wonderful Life has numerous characters, over 30. We only have 5 actors because we're performing it as a period 1940s radio show. So these 5 actors will bring to life, with the help of a live Foley artist who will be making live sound effects throughout the entire show, they will bring to life this full story, which is a familiar tale to many people. But because of the way it's done, it's told in this new format. And it's a great challenge because we're used to building normal sets and playing normal characters. But now, as actors, as directors, as scenic designers, we have to say, how do we build a radio station? How do we make it feel like these people who are coming to see this play are in a radio station in the 1940s, watching 1940s voice actors and actresses do a radio play with their silly little live Foley man making his snow crunching with shoes on cornflakes. And now I'm going to read just a little excerpt from It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play, playing numerous parts myself right here. So here we go. I'm getting the signal from our stage manager that we will be on the air in 20 seconds. Thank you all for coming this evening and enjoy the broadcast. We are at 5432 WPDQ in New York City. This is WPDQ, Playhouse of the Air. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, young and old and new. Greetings from WPDQ Studio A in Manhattan, New York, right here in the US of A. I'm your host, Freddie Fillmore, and it is my pleasure to bring you your favorite stories this and every week on WPDQ Playhouse of the Air. Tonight, we bring you a real feel-good heart warmer, perfect for this or any Christmas Eve. It's a Wonderful Life. We begin our story in the little town of Bedford Falls, New York, where a number of people in town are praying for their dear friend, a typical American dreamer named George Bailey. Dear God, please look over my husband, George. George is a good boy, you know that? My son has always gone out of his way to give others a hand. Now it's him who needs help. Help my big brother, George. He's done so much for all of us, more than I remember. I remember all the times he would stay late after work and not ask a cent. The world needs more like George Bailey. George Bailey never thinks about himself. I wouldn't have a roof over my head if it wasn't for him. If it wasn't for him, I would have given up long ago. All I think about is myself. I must have taken the last cent he had.
He had no sense of business, that George Bailey, just like his father. None of the Baileys were ever businessmen. It's his own fault if he wasn't prepared for times like these.
At times like these, I can't help but think it's all my fault. Help him, Father. It's me who's putting him through all this. Something's the matter with Daddy. Should we pray for him, Mommy? Yes, Zuzu, pray. Pray very hard.
And the voices carry heavenward, and Joseph, the superintendent of angels, summons Clarence, an apprentice angel.
And that is where I will leave you, listeners and friends, to come see the play, the Brown County Playhouse, and hear the rest of the story about George Bailey and his wonderful life. Thank you for listening and giving me this time. If you would like some tickets, go to www.browncountyplayhouse.org or contact the box office at 812-988-6555.
This is Dave Seastrom with the Brown County Hour, and it's my pleasure to introduce Brown County's own Mel Chance, big band leader, clarinet player, saxophone player. Welcome. Glad to have you here this evening.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you grew up in Indianapolis, and you got your start in music playing the piano, is that correct?
Correct. My mother played piano, so she thought it would be nice at 5 years old for me to start learning to play piano. Well, after 5 years of that, her sitting on one end of the stool, practice, come on, do it right, I got sick of it. So they made the mistake of taking me to the Lyric Theater and introduced me to Benny Goodman that night at the Lyric, and boy, I got hooked on clarinet. And from that point on, please, Mom, can I? And she said, well, okay. And that's how it got started. And I've been playing clarinet ever since.
Benny Goodman is one of your major influences?
I would say so, yes. He actually, very well trained artist. He had to learn classical music, and then he was influenced by some of his friends to get into the big band era, and wow, he can play.
So primarily your band is a dance band?
Yes. My Notables, the seven-piece band I played with, I'm the leader of that here. In fact, it was organized here from the community band. I just picked people that never had any experience with dance band before, and I put them together because I'm kind of one of these kind of guys that likes to see what I can do with nothing. And I was also probably the first director of the community band, so I had a little influence to ask them to come in, and they did that. I was on the East Coast playing, and also the reason I was there playing on the East Coast is I was in the Korean affair in the Navy, and I was stationed in Norfolk, and when I got out, I got to traveling with a trio called the Nephews. Well, after we traveled up and down for a while, I decided I wanted to come home. And a friend of mine that we kind of was in scouting together, but he played tenor, and he called me, he said, I got a band I want you to hear. I said, okay. He knew I was back in town, so I went, and of course it was down in the basement of a telephone company where there's cement walls, cement floor, cement ceilings and everything, whoa. And so, well, why am I here? Well, the guys wanted to know if you would help them organize this band and get it to go. And to make a long story short, it became Mel Chance and the Belltones. And the Belltones, of course, is because I was an employee of the Indiana Bell.
There you go.
So that was kind of an interesting thing. And you know, we stayed together for, 14 years without ever having a substitute. And that was pretty unreal. But anyway, we played at the Roof. We played at all the country clubs. Back then, the country clubs hired big bands. And then as the Elvises and people come on, you know, and the Beatles, the big bands started dwindling. But we really had a fine time playing all kinds of ballroom dancing. And remember, the one group that really hired us regularly was the Singletons in Indianapolis, because they took lessons for ballroom dancing, and they liked cha-chas and all the Latin music and the waltzes. And I said, ooh, okay, let's do it. And so we played a lot of ballroom for them.
Earlier, when we were discussing Indianapolis, you mentioned that you did spend a little time with Wes Montgomery.
Yes, I did. I was thrilled to death to be his friend. We didn't get to be real close because about the time I met him, he was in a little, I guess you'd call it a little nightclub on the west side of Indianapolis on West 30th Street. And a good bass friend of mine invited me to go to hear him. And that night, there was kind of like a talent show, and for some reason, my name got put in the hat to try sing that night, and Wes invited me to come up. We did a number that was called Poinciana, and it just like we'd always played it. You know, it was sounded like it was well rehearsed. Well, was it? It was right off the seat of your pants. Well, anyway, he came to me later on the break and says, if we get a chance, I want to record that. Well, lo and behold, somehow he went on the road, then he got to be the number one guitarist in the country. I never got to talk to him or see him again, so.
Mel, what brought you to Brown County?
Well, I've always wanted a log cabin. So my wife says, I have a girlfriend that I used to go to grade school with that's down here in the real estate business. And I said, well, that's kind of interesting. Why don't we call her? And it's our anniversary weekend. Yeah, come on down and I'll buy you anniversary dinner. So we went over to the Brown County Inn and we had lunch, and they're talking away, catching up on old times and being old school girlfriends, you know. And I says, time out. What? I says, I understand you're in the real estate business. Do you have any log homes to sell? Oh, would you like to see one? Oh, my goodness. Well, right after lunch, we saw several. But the very first one I saw was the one I fell in love with. It was natural hewn logs. It had the real glass, not the glass we have now, but it, you know, it had that imperfection in it, real glass. And I thought, man, this is it. So that's how it all came out down here.
We're going to hear a song called God's Eye View that's with the Mile High Band. And Mel, you toured the Summer Olympics in Athens with your nephew with this band. Is that correct?
Yes, my great nephew. Lo and behold, I didn't even know he had any kind of talent at all when I saw him. He kept coming to all our family reunions with his little trumpet, and did get to go to down to Nashville, Tennessee at the Belmont University. And he graduated, and he called me. Uncle Mel, please come down and play in my band. I said, well, Denver didn't even know you had a band. Well, yeah, I do. And come on down. And boy, I went down there, and all these college kids, man, I tell you what, their temples were unreal, faster than I ever played before. But anyway, I did. I sat in, and right off the bat, hey, take a solo. Oh, no. So, all right, I did. And that was a fun night. And then as time went on, he kept calling me to record with him. And this is how this God's Eye View came into being. He wrote this especially for me. And I said, you're kidding. No, he said, this is especially for you. Well, he sent me a CD with the rhythm section. Okay, that's interesting. What's the melody line? And he just said, just fill in right here. Okay. So when I got down to the, we actually recorded this on the campus there, Belmont University. And so when it come my turn, I had my earphones on and I played my little number. Well, we had to take about 8 or 9 shots at it. But when I heard it, I could not believe it, because they can take things electronically and, oh, we'll take this good part and this good part. And put it. I said, that don't sound like what I played. Well, it was, but they took the best parts of it. So,
it's sort of a dog's breakfast then.
Yeah, smorgasbord.
They're smorgasbord.
The grass a little greener. Well, I've never seen the sky so blue. People don't know why my eyes are so much brighter. Oh, I'll tell you, man, they haven't got a clue. Well, I've seen the light of God.
love and joy, peace that passes understanding, a servant's heart without having to be so demanding. He puts a smile on your face, convinces your soul to feel brand new with the God's eye view.
This is Dave Seastrom with the Brown County Hour. The holidays have different meanings and practices for each of us. The season gives us the perfect opportunity to experience family traditions that have been passed down, a way of connecting with times past and our own heritage. This is what the season is all about. Families getting together, sharing stories, and somewhere near the top of the list, eating special foods. All of this helps to make these occasions something we look forward to. No matter how we celebrate the holidays, one thing we all agree on is how much we look forward to our special holiday meals. Whether it's latkes or lutefisk, borscht or beans, haggis or hotcakes, if your grandmother made them, you look forward to eating some during the holiday festivities. The custards and cakes, and those special cookies, or even the proverbial figgy pudding, or all the things dreams are made of. Without them, there would be no sugar plum fairy, no fruitcake that comes in the mail from Aunt Agnes, and the stockings would have nothing stuffed in them. In my own family, my dad's side is Scandinavian, and the Christmas smorgasbord was always something to behold. The table was decked out from one side to the other with meats and cheeses and pastries and pudding, dark Swedish rye bread, and everyone's favorite, meatballs. There was something for everyone. Grandma and my aunts spent many days making sure that everything was prepared exactly the way Grandma Peterson made them. The descendants of immigrants feel an obligation to preserve the past and to pass this memory forward. Amongst the offerings were foods that came about as a result of hard times and the lack of refrigeration. Food that came from a time when nothing was wasted. We offsprings were made to eat foods that our ancestors ate. I suppose this was a way of informing us of just exactly how much better off we are. There was blood sausage and head cheese, both too horrible to describe, but the standout in my memory was lutefisk. Starting with a whitefish, the fillets are soaked in lye, dried on a clothesline, and stacked away on a shelf. This was a safe way to store this food because neither mouse nor bacteria would eat it, and who could blame them? When the time came, the fish shingles were boiled in water that was changed 3 times in order to remove the lye. What you were left with was essentially flavorless fish glop. The final preparations depended on what was at hand. If you had cream and onions, that would go into the recipe. If not, it could be just hardtack, which is a perfectly named cracker. As children, we had to eat a given amount before we were allowed to feast on Grandma's pastries. Trembling in anticipation, a mouthful provided a lifetime of memories, which were fortunately superseded by the more appetizing offerings that we truly loved, like the traditional Swedish dish, Mexican wedding cookies. As a young adult, I met a Swede who was here visiting. When the topic of lutefisk came up, he laughed, saying, "We know of this food, but no one eats it." Well, so much for tradition. I've heard unsubstantiated rumors of a local holiday dish that tops them all, Brown County's own possum haggis. Now, here's a holiday treat no one wants to miss. First, you get yourself a nice, fresh possum. You don't want one that's been in the road too long for sanitary reasons, and you don't want one that's been overly tenderized by passing motorists. Plump and ripe is the way to go. As it's been described to me, the preparation is pretty straightforward. you simply invert the possum into its own pouch, add a few onions and some hot sauce, and bake it whole until it's nice and tender. I suppose this could be served with candy canes to add a holiday flair. In our own household, we skipped the lutefisk, and my children were never made to eat blood pudding or other questionable treats from the old country. We stick to a more standard fare, like turkey or honey-baked ham. No matter where your culinary adventures take you, 'tis the season for making memories, and we hope you and yours have a fine holiday. This is Dave Seastrom with the Brown County Hour, wishing peace on earth and goodwill to all. See you next time. And we'll be right back after station identification.
Brown County Hour is underwritten by Riverlight Yoga, where we practice mindful yoga with precise instruction and plenty of silence. Join us for Warm Up From Within at the Abe Martin Lodge, January 17th through 19th, for 3 days of mind-body-spirit exploration. See riverlightyoga.com for full information.
You are listening to the Brown County Hour on volunteer-powered community radio WFHB at 100.7 in Brown County, 91.3 and 98.1 in Bloomington, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at wfhb.org. Welcome back to episode 21 of the Brown County Hour. In this segment, we bring you a back-in-time report on local hippies, a history discussion with Bill Land, some more great music from Mel Chance, a special holiday poem from Gunther Flum, and a live report from the dedication of the Salt Creek Trail.
I'm going to the country, got to get away.
We are recording, by the way.
Okay. All right.
Spoons, Foster, grab the
then spoon. Give us the 1, 2, 3, man, and we'll roll on.
Okay. Take it away, Dave.
Hello. This is Walter Concrete with the Brown County Hour. This morning, we'll be cranking up the Richard Fish Way Back in Time machine and bringing you some hippie news from the 1970s. We're seeing more and more of these long-haired invaders in Brown County. They're arriving with their families, and it looks like they're here to stay. There's been an out-and-out invasion along Plum Creek, and the casual observer can easily see clusters of teepees surrounded by semi-naked hippies, laughing and carrying on. Reports are coming in from all over the county, as sightings of naked swimmers at the now infamous Bear Ass Lake have attracted large crowds of locals hoping to get a look. The natives are completely upset. Even the streets of Nashville are now host to these long-haired, wildly dressed young people. They apparently have no morals whatsoever. The horrible music, their disrespect for the American way of life, and their unpatriotic anti-war activities have more than a few Brown Countyans completely upset. At a recently called public meeting, the sheriff was quoted as saying that as far as he can tell, it's not illegal to be a hippie. He assured the anxious group of concerned citizens that he's looking into it, and if there is any way to stop this invasion, he will see to it. In an attempt to bring some clarity to this story, we have found two people that we believe are actual hippies, and they have agreed to speak with us this morning. Let me introduce you to Mr. Natural and his companion, Seashell. Good morning, Mr. Natural. Before we begin, is this your actual name?
Yeah, man. It's naturally my actual name.
Do you mean to tell me that your mother named you that?
Well, not exactly. Mom has her good points, but picking names is not one of them. No one wants to be called Sydney.
What about you, Miss Seashell? Is that your given name?
For
First off, man, it's Ms. Seashell. That paradigm has shifted and those sexist, derogatory, submissive titles no longer apply. But to answer your question, yes, I was given that name, but not by my mother. You can call me Shelley.
To help us understand what's going on here, Nate, if I may call you that, let's start with you. In your own words, what is a hippie, and why would you want to be one?
Man, the name's natural, man. No Nate or Nit involved here.
Okay, sorry. Back to my question.
Dude, the word hippie is a media invention. I kind of like it, but we're making it up as we go along, you know, so there is no definition. To answer your other question, why would you want to be anything else? I mean, it's we're free, we live as we want. It's not like your world is exactly working out. We're making something new here, and we like it.
What do you mean by new?
I'll answer that one. We're part of the Back to the Land movement, and we have no interest in the consumeristic 9-to-5, detached from the earth way of life that has brought about endless wars and environmental destruction. We're seeking harmony with Mother Earth and peace with all humankind. We intend to change the world one garden at a time with each child we raise and every convention we do away with. It's in the music, it's in the air, and we're all in this together.
That seems a little ambitious. Do you really think you can change the world?
Well, man, if we don't do it, who will? Check back with me in 40 years.
So, there you have it. Actual hippies in their own words. Back to you, Dave. This is Dave Seastrom with the Brown County Hour, bringing you a far-out report for all you old hippies and everyone. Some 40 years later, peace and love.
This is Bill Land with the Land and Lore of Brown County. We talked a little bit about the geology and the topography of this wonderful county. Let me say that the water moves through this county, the good old Bean Blossom Creek, and it moves into Lake Lemon and heads out down toward the Wabash and finally into the Ohio. And then Salt Creek, it goes into Lake Monroe and it ends up the same place. So if you had a little boat that was floated in one of these creeks, it'd end up all the way down in New Orleans. How about that? The glaciers shaped the northern part of the county, made it very, very flat. The southern part of the county is in the Norman Upland, and it is resistant rock that caps these hills. The water and the erosion has made these deep ravines all over the place. The Wisconsin Ice Age, you can find parts of that up by Martinsville, and all the glacial till came down toward the Bean Blossom Overlook and Pine Bluff and that area near Bean Blossom, and it all stopped and gave us quite a lot of debris. This wonderful glacier, the Wisconsin, was really important in leaving a lot of gold and diamonds. We find diamonds over near Gatesville, and actually diamonds in Plum Creek and Bear Creek. In fact, there's a little town that most of us don't even have never heard of, and it's called Klondike, and it was on Bear Creek. It was a gold rush town at one time, and I hear even people try to bury their horses, but they buried their horses in big gold deposits. Now you've got to realize that you don't necessarily want to dig there. It might not be a real pleasant experience. You might want to dig at least 10 feet away from that old horse. The Bean Blossom Overlook, Pine Bluff, was where the Illinoisan Ice Age stopped about 14,000 years ago. This is a long, long time ago. And actually, the ice melted back from the state. It's pretty much gone about 15,000 years ago, 14, 15, 12, in that range. Gray shale all throughout Plum Creek. Wonderful, wonderful deposits for what we call body clay. And those skinny dippers that really put that body clay all over them, they could wash that clay off instantly. And boy, how do we love that clay and gold Plum Creek. And that was part of the geology. Lots of ponds and lakes in this county, but all of them are man-made. It's about over 600, making it the most lakes in the entire state. Really, these impoundments of water were for water supply. The ravines, on all their deep, with interfluves in between. Resistant sandstone and siltstone, dry ridges on top. You can see those dry ridges in a distance just looking at the old chestnut oaks. They love dry ridges. Well drained. You can't dig a well here because it just wouldn't have any water at all. That's why the ponds were there. The forest soil is very acidic in this area, too. You see the tall tan grasses throughout the year, particularly in the fall, and that shows how acidic the soil is. And we know how clay is and how muddy it is and how sticky it is. Just try to drive a pick-em-up truck right down those county lanes when the mud is all around, and boy, is that slippery and sticky. The Salt Creek Valley, a wonderful broad valley going down near Story, is a glacial sluiceway. Imagine a huge, huge wall of water going down through there for many, many years, actually making that valley a lot broader than it would be otherwise. Salt deposits were mined, and many of the early settlers used salt for some of their commodities. Geodes are famous in this county as well. We are in the geode belt, which runs north, west, to south, east throughout the county. Those geodes that look like a big piece of cauliflower have a hole in the center often. Maybe a fossil was in there at one time about 350,000 years ago. The fossil decayed, the water seeped in into the geode, made the little silicon like a little cave. Brilliant, brilliant, white, beautiful crystals. And if you ever see a geode with darker crystals, it means it's really a lot older, perhaps iron deposits. This wonderful topography and geology of Brown County makes Brown County one of the most unique and perfect counties to study geology and study the rocks, study the landscape, especially if you get out there and just spend days and days and days enjoying our wonderful nature. This has been Bill Land, the land and lore of Brown County.
Now, back to Dave's interview with Mel Chance.
Now, who did you play with while you recorded the Blue Moon?
Well, the Blue Moon was with my band, the Notables.
The Notables.
It's a notable experience, believe me. I want to get a little, you know, plug in there. We had just got back from Purdue University to play for a wedding that night. And then the next morning, we had this date to do this recording. We had to sit down and make a format of what we wanted to do, how to make it move smoothly as possible, like fast number, slow number. My great nephew said, please do at least one or two songs, because I think you can really sell the song. I said, okay. But he didn't have anything to do with, you know, helping with the recording. But I started that song, and I had a very good friend of mine out of the Navy arrange this song for me. Very commercial type sound, but I've had a lot of people say, boy, you sound like Mel Torme. And I said, get out of here. But anyway.
One Mel to another.
Yeah, one Mel to the other. But I'm glad they felt that way, because then that helps sell the song, you know. So we did that. And as you listen to it, I'm sure you will enjoy it. My heart. Without a love of my own, Blue Moon, you knew just what I was there for. You heard me sing a prayer for someone I really could care for. And then you suddenly appeared before me, the only somebody whispered, please adore me. And when I looked, the moon had turned to gold. Blue moon, now I'm no longer alone. Without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. Thank you.
Now, every year at Christmas time, I like to take a chance to dine with my friend who makes a feast from different parts of different beasts. Now, oftentimes, it's kind of scary eating something strange and hairy. Even though I must confide, I'll take that chance at Yuletide. Because my friend's the kind of cook, there ain't no menu in a book that has that special type of twist to make up meals that don't exist. And so my friend is always itching to get himself inside that kitchen and bring his friends and family cheer from critters they both hate and fear. Of course, you have to be quite brave to eat a thing you'd never crave. But every year, there's some surprise that he's prepared before your eyes, for my good buddy stands alone and cooking things with parts unknown. Now, my good friend has got the nerve to trap and catch the things he'll serve, which most of you, you must admit, at Christmas dinner where you sit, might seem to think it's kind of nuts to cook a critter with its guts. But all you need is just one bite, after you get past the fright of finding something on your plate that you ain't never seen or ate, then you'll become like me, a fan of how my friend lives off the land. Why, he might cube or mince or dice a frog and turtle stuffed with mice. Why, there ain't nothing he ain't seen that he can't catch and he can't cream. There's parts of critters he might toss in every stuffing super sauce, but he's the only one with spunk to baste a groundhog with a skunk or put together in a bowl a marinade of worms and mole. Well, there ain't nothing he won't try to find a creature he can fry, or any way that he can stop from hunting critters he can chop. You can't believe the things he'll bake, like muskrat wrapped in rattlesnake, or not consider it too crass to stuff a veer up with bass, or make a cake that has a swirl of raccoon tails and some a squirrel, nor any way you can compare a critter cooked with its own hair. I know you're probably asking why I have my Christmas with this guy, but there's no snow I won't go through to guess what parts are in his stew, for sometimes he can be quite smug when you can't guess what kind of bug that you can find in every scoop in each mysterious bowl of soup. So in that dinner set before us from hills and valleys in our forest, you'll find there's things we'd never eat that he can make a Christmas treat. Like chocolate-covered candied fox ringed with roaches in a box. And though I know it sounds insane, but try his crawdad candy cane. Of course, there's always possum pie with flowers crust with butterfly. And in his ice cream, you won't know if he's got sparrows, owl, or crow. And there's no way that you'll get fat with caramel-coated wings of bat. So you can see I've got my reason every Christmas at this season to have my dinner at his table. If by chance I think I'm able to try each Christmas as cuisine to dine on things I've never seen, I bring my own Pepto-Bismol. Happy Holy Days from Gunther Flum.
This is Vera Grubbs. Pam Rader and I attended the Salt Creek Trail dedication on Friday, November 8th. Bob Curlin reminds us we are always on Brown County time, but we do get it done.
I was going through my archive today. I found a couple of things. I found a press release of September 10th, 2004. And this press release says, congratulations, Niceville and Brown County. We have $850,000 for a trail. Let me tell you that this is one of the very few trails you should be very proud in the state of Indiana that was built, and this is important to know, our match, which was over $250,000, came from donations from this community. We also are blessed to have Mr. Eric Cook, who's your representative here.
I'll tell you, there were several moments where this could have died. Other people could have said, you know, this is too much. We have lots going on. Let's pull the plug. Let's scale it down. But you didn't, and your leadership didn't. And that's why we're here today, and that's why we're going to have more ceremonies as this trail unfolds. This is also a great example of the kind of state and local partnerships we need more of in Indiana. This should be replicated around the state because this shows it works. And this is a trail that's going to be enjoyed by Hoosiers and visitors alike, thousands, ten thousands, hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of people for generations to come. And this is your legacy. There'll be a day when none of us are left. The people will walk this trail. They may or may not know the history of it, but they're going to appreciate it, I guarantee you. So congratulations. Keep up the good work. Well done.
Now we'll pause for station identification. County Hour is underwritten by Riverlight Yoga, where we practice mindful yoga with precise instruction and plenty of silence. Join us for Warm Up From Within at the Abe Martin Lodge, January 17th through 19th, for 3 days of mind-body-spirit exploration. See riverlightyoga.com for full information.
You are listening to the Brown County Hour on volunteer-powered community radio WFHB at 100.7 in Brown County, 91.3 and 98.1 in Bloomington, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at wfhb.org.
Welcome back to episode 21 of the Brown County Hour. In our final segment this morning, we bring you some poetic observations from Chris Curtin, an interview with local stained glass artist Ann Ryan Miller, another installment of Local Forest History with Charlie Cole and Linda Baden, a news bulletin from Rick Fettig, and more big band music from Mel Chance.
This is Chris Curtin with a poem called Chicken Parts. The vegetarian hunter-gatherer slouches toward the kitchen, his prey a dinner in a box, rice and vegetables resting in cold comfort in the frozen wasteland of the freezer. He makes the catch with an effortless ease, born of many years of practice. But wait, what's this in the ingredients? Chicken parts? Could they be a little more specific? There's no bragging of great breasts or boasting of fine thighs. No unsettling hints of the cross-species relations of buffalo wings. Just parts. What was their origin? Did chickens give them up like eggs? Or were they from a chicken parts dealer? New and used chicken parts. A part for every chicken, a chicken for every part. Or were they found in rural junkyards where you could stroll up and down row upon row in an unmown field, covered with the hulks of old or wrecked chicken carcasses, where you took the parts off yourself with the socket wrench you brought along for that purpose? Were classic vintage parts of an old chicken more highly prized? Or should you comb the yard for newer parts for a low-mileage bird that had been involved in an unfortunate accident? Were they parts one could speak about openly in mixed company without fear of offending or embarrassing others? Or were these private parts, spoken of only in whispers, by men and women of questionable character?
This is Vera Grubbs with the Brown County Hour for WFHB, and I'm speaking today with Ann Ryan Miller. She is a quintessential glass artist. We're in your studio, and it's fascinating. Tell me a little bit about the studio.
Well, actually, the studio was originally Dale Basir's studio. And when they built this house, we're living in his house and Grandma Ruth's house, my husband Steve's grandparents' house. And this was his painting studio. And originally it was the cow barn turned into the painting studio. And when we moved here in 1982, we put an addition on. And so one side is a working side and one side is more like a gallery side.
And then did you have training for your glass work?
I never was really trained. In fact, I wasn't trained in art at all. But when I moved, and I was here for 2 weeks, and I didn't have that much to do because I was just a visitor, and I met a woman. Her name was Mary Ott, and she was a very fine painter, but she'd started doing stained glass 6 months before. And she was part of the ashram. Do you remember the Rudy?
I do, in the restaurant.
Yep, in the restaurant. And so she had done all the windows and lamps for the Dow restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, you know, we got along really well. She says, well, if you have nothing to do, I could really use help cleaning and installing these windows and lamps. I said, okay. We got along really well, and I ended up moving to Bloomington. I joined the ashram, and I was we started a stained glass business together and eventually grew. There were seven of us. It's downtown on the square in Bloomington called Graphic Glass.
Those were the days.
Those were the days.
So now we have you here almost over 30 years as an artist.
I've been doing glass since 76, so
like
36 years.
Yeah. And your philosophy has a lot to do with the interaction of nature in your mind,
mm-hmm.
that comes out in your glass work.
It's my religion, let's just say that. I think for a lot of people, especially who live in Brown County, that's why we're here. We're here because there's something special. It's not just beautiful, but there's something very special in the land. I used to always think of it as kind of womb-like and very inviting, and it's a place that you can nurture that spirit in ourselves and the connection with nature and God and whatever, however you envision it for yourself. But yeah, I can't get enough of it. I cannot get, somebody said, oh, I can't wait till the gloom lifts. We have a couple of rainy days here. And I said, I really like it because I can stay inside. You know, I can get something done because if it's nice out, I just want to be out, whether I'm walking in the woods or with the horses and animals or in the gardens, or I love growing food and picking food and eating food and looking for wild food. And I don't know, I just like it all. And so that translates, I mean, I feel so fortunate that I can actually have a career being inspired by something that is dear to me, absolutely dear to me, and it's all positive. You know, nature's all, it is what it is. There's no real negative. It's just, it is, you know, and I can just always be inspired no matter what. I mean, I remember,
I think our philosophies are very similar.
The living connection. There's for me, there's a real energetic connection. I feel right. Mm-hmm. It feels right. It feels home. I know a lot of people feel that, and I think as things degrade in the world, more and more people are coming to that realization of that connection and how important it is. If I don't have nature, like, for a day or two, I don't know what to do with myself. I always go look, you know, even if I'm in a very urban situation, I'll go walk alleys or I'll look for things growing in the cracks of sidewalks, yeah, or the birds flying over. I think that my feeling and reverence, respect for nature and the amazing, complicated sense of beauty and aesthetic that's in nature, I think that comes across with what I do. And so that's an influence. I hope that people see that. They see the light and the color, the way the light comes through and the shadows and the shapes, and they, you know, feel the same connection that I feel, maybe.
Well, I think we can wrap it up.
All right.
This has been Vera Grubbs for the Brown County Hour here with Anne Ryan Miller in her glass studio.
We continue now with our ongoing series on logging in Brown County featuring Charlie Cole and Linda Baden.
By 1820, the state's population had increased to 147,000. Road building began in earnest in the 1830s. That increased the pressure for lumber on Brown County, since roads are now available to move that lumber out of the county throughout the state. And the demand for lumber increased exponentially. Most homes in the era were built of wood and also were heated with wood, which required 20 to 40 cords of wood annually for heating and cooking. 8,000 poles were necessary to fence in a 40-acre lot. So the demand for wood was huge. To get an idea of the scope of logging that was taking place in this time period, at the time of European settlement, there was 19,500,000 acres of forest land in the state. By 1860, there were only 10 million acres of forest land remained. So in that short period of time, half of the forest land had already been decimated. From 1860 through 1910, these lands continued to be cleared, especially in Brown County, for farm development and for wood production. The regular burning of the forest was a common practice to improve it for livestock grazing, and the subsequent operations removed whatever wasn't taken in the first round of harvesting. Many areas in Brown County, farmers attempted to grow crops on, and that resulted in a terrible erosion problem.
There was a special agricultural implement used in Brown County called the hillside plow. Most normal horse-drawn plows had one shovel and one set of handles, and they went in one direction only. Because when they were farming on the ridges, they had very stressful conditions to turn their horses around, they developed the hillside plow, which had two shovels, one facing in each direction, and a handle that swiveled 380 degrees. So when they reached the end of a furrow, they would unhook the horse, hook him back to the other end, swivel the handles around, and off they went.
And the lack of a really good soil base in Brown County, these kinds of practices, unsustainable practices, the poor soil to start with, led to the demise of many of these subsistence farms.
From, I think, 70,000 people in 1830, by 1890, I believe there was like 17,000 people because they'd all moved on to new farms. The mark of a good farmer was how many farms that they had worn out during their farming career.